Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. I am Ben Williams, your host. Today, I'm pleased to relay to you on the immortal light and the celebration of Christmas. We'll wrap the episode with our reading of the three books of occult philosophy. If you like this podcast, please consider subscribing to our magazine, The Rocky Mountain Mason. You may do so at rockymountainmason.com. And check out esotericmason.com, our biannual publication, The Esoteric Mason. I'm pleased to say that both these publications are readying for printing. They should be out in the next couple of weeks. Now, if you'd like to submit an article for publication in either of those publications, please write to me at ben@rockymountainmason.com. Again, that's ben@rockymountainmason.com. On the immortal light and the celebration of Christmas. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the date of December 25th was first identified as the date of Jesus' birth by Sextus Julius Africanus in 221 AD. The date had previously been held for the celebration of Dies Solis Invictinati, or the Day of Birth of the Unconquered Sun. Although this may be seen as a Christianizing of pagan impulses, it is not an untoward symbolism to equate the nadir of the year, and thus the imminent rise of the sun's annual course, with the inception of the divine spark. Some claim the inverse, that the Emperor Aurelian chose the date for the festival of Sol Invictus to coincide with an already extant Christian celebration in order to compete and diminish extension of the early church. Consider also that December 25th is 9 months after March 25th. Conception at the vernal equinox, or thereabouts, would result in a winter solstice birth. Thus Easter and Christmas are related, the one concealed within the other, in holy resonance. Keeping a different calendar, the Armenian Apostolic Church, one of the earliest Christian churches in the world, celebrates the birth of the Christ child on January 6th, and the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church on January 7th. Now, whatever the reason, by the 9th century, Christmas was widely celebrated, although in a marked lesser degree than Easter at this time of year. The use of the evergreen as symbolizing everlasting life in the midst of winter, and thus the advent of the Christmas tree, appears first on the Christian record in the early 17th century. Apparently, fir trees dressed with apples appeared in Strasbourg around 1605. The incorporation of candles to the trees is recorded by a Silesian duchess in 1611. In Queen Victoria's time, her husband Albert would then popularize the tradition in the Victorian age, and soon Christmas trees would be ubiquitous in Christendom. Of course, use of the evergreen for celebration in Saturnalia in ancient Rome precedes these dates by centuries. December 21st, the winter solstice, corresponds with the sun's entry into the tropical sign of Capricorn, Saturn's night house. In the northern hemisphere, this is the shortest day of the year, the onset of winter. Then, one moon hence, the sun enters Aquarius, Saturn's day house. The days lengthen, the dominion of the night hours yet maintains strength until the ascent of the sun across the ecliptic and into the sign Aries. And the day conquers the night. Life returns to the earth. Thus, the festival of Saturnalia corresponds with the sun's sojourn through the signs most distant from the sun and moon's domiciles, Leo and Cancer, respectively, through Saturn's dominion, significant perhaps of that knowledge and wisdom that enables surfeit of plenty through a season most inimical to life, at least in the northern climes. Saturn's association with solitariness, coldness, old age, restriction, but also wisdom and experimentation probably spring from the personification of this necessity to survive the winter months, take discipline and preparation in equal measure. Be rash, and Cronos will reap you with his blade. Saturnalia is not unlike the celebration of Yule, wherein the Norse god Odin occupies similar capacity. Note that Odin is sometimes depicted as a wish-granting deity with a long white beard, astride an eight-legged horse aloft in flight. One of Odin's names in Norse translates to Longbeard. We'll get to that later. The custom of giving gifts at Christmas time, contemplated perhaps with mind to the gifts of the Magi presented at the manger, or with the impulse that the Christ child was God's gift to the world, probably originated in the 15th century. Note that the feast day of St. Nicholas, among the inspirations that came to be embodied by Santa Claus, perhaps, is not December 25th, but December 6th. Wary of similar distortions that plague the holiday season today, over commercialization and drunkenness among them, after the defeat of Charles Stuart in the English Civil War, the Puritan government banned Christmas for 13 years in England, from 1647 through 1660. In Scotland, where the holiday had once been welcomed by James I and the IV, Parliament abolished observance of Christmas in 1640 as a purging of superstition. It wasn't until 1958 that it became a public holiday in Scotland. In the US, it took until 1870 for Christmas to become a legally recognized federal holiday. Nonetheless, through the course of the centuries, like the course of the sun's annual revolution, symbolism of the awakening light predominates, the light of salvation. But something changed over the 20th century particularly, wherein emerged the true icon of modern-day Christmas celebrations, that amorphous Christ, Santa Claus. Santa Claus, Sinterklaas, Father Christmas, St. Nicholas, St. Nick, Kris Kringle, or just plain Santa, the amalgamation and emergent archetype of mishmashed folkloric legend of the fabled St. Nicholas of the 4th century Bishop of Myra, riddled with Father Christmas of Victorian England and raised by Odin and God knows what else. Now some blame the mushroom Amanita muscaria for the effigy and, of course, the flying reindeer. Whatever the origin of this portly character, now bent on bolstering consumption worldwide, a curious inversion is undeniably extant in the Gentile appearance of this jolly man. An inversion, in this sense, as I employ the term, is a concealing of an antithesis within a thesis, one thing concealed in the appearance of its opposite. Modern Santa Claus raises a base archetype, in the rubicund complexion of an open spirit, commercialism, acquisitiveness, untruth, and materialism become propagated. Santa Claus renders the esoteric, concealed nature of the season, the immortal light, into a bombastic, bloated body, a grossness of exoteric form that obscures the subtle from contemplation. Instead of introspection, the season turns to consumption. Instead of love thy neighbor, the season aggrandizes separateness of family. Acquisitiveness supplants inquisitiveness. The slippery slope is gilded with bells. The archetype borrows from holy places, but stitches together a Frankenstein's monster. St. Nicholas is the patron saint of sailors, merchants, archers, repentant thieves, prostitutes, children, brewers, pawnbrokers, unmarried people, and students generally. One legend purports him as saving three young women from a life of prostitution by dropping sacks of gold through their window over three successive nights so their father could afford their dowry to essentially marry them off instead. St. Nicholas is also said to have resurrected three children who were murdered and pickled in brine by a butcher who planned to sell them as meat during a famine. Santa Claus has St. Nicholas's feet. Father Christmas appears in 16th century England, clad in green or scarlet robes, often with ivy or evergreen weaved in his hair. This image, along with 19th century caricatures and depictions, influenced the modern depiction of Santa Claus today. Santa Claus appropriates Father Christmas's arms, even his cloak. And Santa Claus stole Odin's beard. Under the subtle influence of commercial desire, a kindling of acquisitiveness to supplant inquisitiveness, the image changed, morphed, pushed by avaricious corporate appetites bent on market share. The role of Coca-Cola, one of the world's largest and most pervasive corporate entities, I mean, you can buy a Coke in sub-Saharan Africa on Tuesday, and you can buy it with dollar bills. The influence of Coca-Cola cannot be overstated. In the colors of Coke's trade dress, the demigod emerges, wrapped in plastic petals like a polythene rose, a fully fledged, universal icon stamped into the consciousness of the age. Santa Claus is like a mirror wherein the world turns upside down. What do I mean by this inversion? It's commonplace in so-called chaos magic to practice inversion, a favored secreting away to curry power. I'm no fan of chaos magic. To me, it's all self-obsessed and egocentric about the practitioner becoming God and whatnot, as if there could be room for God plus one at the wedding feast. But if the chaos magician can become God, who's getting married? Anyway, I'm no fan of chaos magic. Alas, its narcissism is well-suited for the 21st century. Crowley knew, in his ramshackle, roughshod libertinism, fueled by cocaine and clouds of opium, the seed of chaos bulged like a swollen epididymis, ready to spurt nonsense across the world. Undisciplined, slavish to the passions, the chaos magician works to invigorate his own desires, step by step, for self-directed purposes, to champion self over self, as if the ego could somehow be sharpened to excise its own influence. You can't put out the ego with the same candle that emblazons it. Anyway, inversion is all around us in the modern day. It's raised like the ghost of Mammon down Madison Avenue. Every corporate entity the world over, united by the bottom line, is reduced to this lowest common denominator. It necessitates its own hunger, a feast of starvation, awakening more need. That moisturizer you're putting on your heels to stop them from cracking, I tell my wife, that moisturizer is the cause of the dryness. This is inversion. It's infected the government. Consider the likes of the Patriot Act, aptly named, and yet nothing is more unpatriotic than an act which contradicts the Constitution, that supreme law of the land. It's infected religion. Consider the inversion in prosperity doctrine. If God loves you, they say, you will be rich. Christ was poor, even though Christ taught it is harder for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, and that you must give up everything and follow him. Even though Christ taught that, somehow this means an abundance in material things for Christ's followers. All these are Snow White's apple. One bite, you'll remain fast asleep. Santa is just such a vessel. Concealed within the Christmas season is rank materialism. Whether intentionally or not, the impulse spurs society forward, bounded by social norms carefully constructed to lead the stream of consciousness right into Walmart. My hope is the fraternity might once again become the change we wish to see in the world. Freemasonry is not a religion. It's not a dogma. But it does comprise free-thinking men, men who were not reflexively influenced into unthinking obeisance to Mammon and Moloch, right there at the tinseled altar of vanity and stolen dreams. Christ died for our sins, but Santa stuffed them in his sack. This amorphous commercial Christ, this bloated image of avarice and misguided materialism, should probably be ignored. Brethren, look within this Christmas time. Look within and contemplate the immortal light burning inside you. All else is shadows thrown up by the body, just a pile of bones tangled up against the wall. Chapter 18 of the Three Books of Occult Philosophy. Of the Inclinations of Enmities. On the contrary, there are inclinations of enmities, and they are, as it were, the odium and anger, indignation, and a certain kind of obstinate contrariety of nature, so that anything shuns its contrary and drives it away out of its presence. Such kind of inclinations hath rhubarb against choler, treacle against poison, the sapphire stone against hot biles and feverish heats and diseases of the eyes, the amethyst against drunkenness and jasper against flux of blood and offensive imaginations, the emerald and angus castus against lust, achates against poison, peony against the falling sickness, coral against the ebullition of black choler and pains of the stomach. The topaz against spiritual heats, such as our covetousness, lust, and all manner of excesses of love. The like inclination is there also of pismires against the herb origanus, and the wing of a bat, and the heart of a lapwing, from the presence of which they fly. Also, origanum is contrary to a certain poisonous fly, which cannot endure the sun, and resists salamanders and loathes cabbage with such a deadly hatred that they destroy one the other. So cucumbers hate oil, and will run themselves into a ring lest they should touch it. And it is said that the gall of a crow makes men afraid, and drives them away from where it is, as also certain other things. So a diamond doth disagree with the lodestone, that being set by it, it will not suffer iron to be drawn to it, and sheep fly from frog parsley as from some deadly thing. And that which is more wonderful, nature hath pictured the sign of this death in the livers of sheep, in which the very figure of frog parsley being described doth naturally appear. So goats do so hate garden basil, as if there were nothing more pernicious. And again, amongst animals, mice and weasels do disagree. Whence it is said that mice will not touch cheese if the brains of a weasel be put into the rennet, and besides that the cheese will not corrupt with age. So a lizard is so contrary to scorpions that it makes them afraid with its very sight, as also it puts them into a cold sweat. Therefore they are killed with the oil of them, which oil also cures wounds made by scorpions. There is also an enmity betwixt scorpions and mice, wherefore if a mouse be applied to a prick or wound made by a scorpion, it cures it, as it is reported. There is also an enmity betwixt scorpions and stalabores, asps, and wasps. It is reported also that nothing is so much an enemy as snakes, to snakes as crabs, and if swine be hurt therewith, they eat them, and are cured. The sun also being in Cancer, serpents are tormented. Also the scorpion and crocodile kill one another. And if the bird ibis doth but touch a crocodile with one of his feathers, he makes him immovable. The bird, called bustard, flies away at the sight of a horse, and a hart runs away at the sight of a ram, as also of a viper. An elephant trembles at the hearing of the grunting of a hog, so doth a lion at the sight of a cock. The panthers will not touch them that are anointed all over with the broth of a hen, especially if garlic hath been boiled in it. There is also enmity betwixt foxes and swans, bulls and daws. Amongst birds also, some are at a perpetual strife with one with another, as also with other animals, as daws and owls, and the kite, and crows, the turtle, and ringtail, aegippus, and eagles, harts, and dragons. Also, amongst water animals there is an enmity, as betwixt dolphins and whirlpools, mullets and pikes, lampreys and congers. Also the fish called porcontrel makes the lobster so much afraid that the lobster, seeing the other but near him, is struck dead. The lobster and conger tear one the other. The civet cat is said to stand so in awe of the panther that he hath no power to resist him or touch his skin. And they say that if the skins of both of them be hanged up one against the other, the hairs of the panther's skin fall off. And Aurus Apollo saith in his Hieroglyphics, if any one be girt about with the skin of the civet cat, that he may pass safely through the middle of his enemies, and not at all be afraid. Also, the lamb is very much afraid of the wolf, and flies from him. And they say that if the tail or skin or head of a wolf be hanged upon the sheepcoat, the sheep are much troubled and cannot eat their meat for fear. And Pliny makes mention of a bird called marlin that breaks crow's eggs, whose young are annoyed by the fox that she also will pinch and pull the fox's whelps and the fox herself also, which when the crows see, they help the fox against her as against a common enemy. The little bird called linnet, living in thistles, hates asses because they eat the flowers of thistles. Also, there is such a bitter enmity betwixt the little bird called Acillon and the ass that their blood will not mix together, and that at the braying of the ass both the eggs and young of the Acillon perish. There's also such a disagreement betwixt the olive tree and a harlot that if she plant it, it will either be always unfruitful or altogether wither. A lion fears nothing so much as fired torches, and will be tamed by nothing so much as by these. And the wolf fears neither sword nor spear, but a stone, by the throwing of which a wound being made, worms breed in the wolf. A horse fears a camel, so that he cannot endure to see so much as his picture. An elephant, when he rageth, is quieted by seeing of a cock. A snake is afraid of a man that is naked, but pursues a man that is clothed. A mad bull is tamed by being tied to a fig tree. Amber draws all things to it besides garden basil, and those things which are smeared with oil, betwixt which there is a kind of natural antipathy. Well, that is an interesting chapter to end with today. Ultimately, here we are again exploring the doctrine of sympathies, but in this sense from the opposite angle, that while things reinforce each other and like makes like, there is opposites in nature which are usable to, if you like, defeat each other. Of course, some of this does sound like rank superstition, and I'm sure, in fact, it probably is. Although I would like to try the rooster and the naked thing. I don't know if you're familiar with roosters, but they certainly are bold animals. I remember once in my misspent youth, I was in my early 20s, I was working as a soil scientist out on the eastern shore of Maryland, and I used to drink a little too much in those early days of my life, and I remember waking early in the morning, really each morning, to the crowing of a cockerel in the neighbor's yard on the other side of this large hedgerow. One day, I was so disgruntled by being woken, hung over by this darned cockerel, that I stuck my head out the window and I yelled back, cock-a-doodle-doo, and some, you know, unfortunate expletive, I'm sure, adorned my speech. I did so loudly, and the rooster did indeed silence for a while. Well, when I was returning back home after work, I was driving my little red VW up the driveway there. This is in a small town in rural Maryland. And sure enough, as I was getting out of the car, the cockerel had heard me coming home. He must have recognized my engine, and he'd come under this big hedgerow and up the ditch and pop out of the grass, his little head bobbing. And he looked at me, walked kind of close enough that I could see his little beady eye, and he was totally checking me out. I mean, this rooster came to see who it was who had deigned to, you know, disturb his morning vigil of the rising of the sun or what have you. So I did notice at that time in my life the gumption that this this bird has. My mother also had a rooster that used to sneak up on you and attack you when you weren't watching. Of course, you turned around and he would pretend like he was doing something else. He unfortunately met an unfortunate demise in attacking the wrong person. But nonetheless, it would be very interesting to see if this nudity thing that Agrippa mentions is effective in frightening away roosters. I'm not going to try it, but if you want to give it a go, let me know how it goes. Now, part of me wants to point out that I'm not sure that we can entirely take Agrippa literally, although I think that may have been his intent. And I would note that at the beginning of this compendium that he has put together in his 20s, he does mention that there is a lot of stuff in here that the wise should discern between. But I think the important takeaway of this chapter is that there are things which defeat their own purpose when placed together. There is a type of enmity between, if you will, virtues, again using his term, that undermines the efficacy of each. Thus, poison can be countered with its antidote. I'm not exactly sure if, you know, the scorpion, a sting of a scorpion, can be cured by putting a mouse against the sting. But nonetheless, the point here, of course, is that Saturn rules both of these things, and that there is a kind of antipathy between them. So there must be another sort of rulership under which these beings are naturally categorized. This is where Agrippa is coming to these sort of conclusions. Not only is he drawing off sort of, you know, ancient Roman literature and the like, he's also using his understanding of the spheres by which the natural world was classified. So, for example, the scorpion, because it crawls, is saturnine, but yet it is stinged. It is ruled by Mars. So there is a fiery element that is, if you will, assuaged by the coldness of Saturn, which rules mice and rats and the like. So that's one way to look at what he's doing. I think this also goes to show why, if you will, in this worldview, the times at which certain actions are undertaken can either be augmented or, if you will, debilitated, depending on the action undertook and the time and agency sort of having dominion therein, if you follow me. So the analogy I like to give to sort of exemplify this worldview, and this will become more apparent as we get into the celestial magic in book two, but the idea that times for action. So anyone can get to the beach when you're out there in the breakers, swimming to get to the beach. But it is so much easier to wait for the right moment and catch the wave and effortlessly land on the shore. You might get there otherwise, but it might be more difficult, and you might get boiled, so to speak, in the waves by acting in an inappropriate time. Or you may, in fact, you know, not make it at all, hit a riptide or, heaven forbid, drown. The point again here is that there are agencies that augment and debilitate one another, and the pairing of these virtues can be done so as to extend and empower or contract and refrain all suitable action. Well, that's it. Thank you for listening this far. I hope you have a very merry Christmas and a happy holiday season. I hope you caught my drift that the Santa Claus diatribe I gave at the beginning of this podcast was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, though not entirely untrue. we must be sensitive that the world is what we make of it. Therefore, this holiday season, make family central. Take time to reach out to your family, but don't forget your neighbors and those less fortunate than you. Give to somebody you've never met, anonymously, something they need. And until next time, take care, and Godspeed.